Hey guys, how's it going? Well, so the server's back up, but I don't know, WordPress just ate my blog post. Oh, I hate that when that happens. You know, like when Fred Flintstone is falling down the stairs and he's cussing, "That's a fridge, son of a..." Yeah, that's me when my WordPress eats my blog entry. I told you, when I say publish, that means you do what I say, jerk. So here's what I'm writing. Today on the show, Michael Scheuer, Grant F. Smith, sorry, I don't type that fast, and the great Gareth Porter. Don't forget to tell him what time. There, that's 12 to 3 Eastern. All right, so what's going to happen is, I'm going to interview these guys about things on the show today, and, you know, hopefully you'll like to hang around and listen. The first interview will be with Michael Scheuer, then, I already told you in chronological order, yeah, then Grant and Gareth, so. You may be already speculating as to the topics these three wonderful regular guests of ours are going to be discussing on the show today. And you'd be right. I think, probably so. Anyway. Good times. I'm hitting publish on my newly republished blog entry, and we'll see if it takes. I think it looks like perhaps it's working. The last time it took me to some weird error page and said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" Well, geez, you don't usually ask me that when I hit publish. What exactly are you asking me, WordPress? All right, well, it looks like it worked there. Okay, good. That's scotthorton.org/stress. That's my blog. There you go. The Twitter already kicked through to the chat room, so it must be working. The chat room, that's scotthorton.org/chat. Stress for the blog, chat for the chat room, interviews for the interviews, show for the shows, the whole show archives. Articles for the articles, speeches for the speeches, documentaries for the documentaries, just scotthorton.org/whatever you like. It's all there. Very good. Okay, good. scotthorton.org, and by all means, click on those ads, and patronize my sponsors. Okay, good. Let me see here. Ton of news. Oh, let's see. God dang, can I not get anybody on the show today? You know how many invites I've sent out today? All right. At least Prothero, when he says no, he responds quickly. That's good. I like that guy Prothero. He's not a libertarian or anything, but he's a good war reporter. And he does scare the crap out of me every time we talk about what's going on in Iraq. And, well, I guess I thrive off of negativity. Hell, as long as I brought that up, let me go ahead and elaborate a little bit that I'm very pleased, and I think we should all be very pleased at the lack of attention the American establishment and the American media are paying to Iraq right now. Now, that doesn't mean there's not another shoe to drop. But if they were really trying to propagandize the hell out of us into supporting a full-scale air campaign or full-scale invasion or partial-scale invasion or anything like that, it would work. And now Prothero himself at McClatchy Newspapers, Mitchell Prothero, he did report that the CIA and Rangers and Delta and whatever they call themselves now, Combat Applications Group and whatever other acronyms and euphemisms they have, second and first tier special forces are there in Kurdistan and they're building up their base. Life at the Erbil Airport is very exciting lately. And life at the base is getting busy too, drones in the air. So it's on. And you know what? I don't know. Maybe we're just waiting for John McCain to have Iraq come back to his attention. There's so much other stuff going on right now with the Israeli slaughter in Gaza and the controversy in Ukraine. I don't know. False flag by the anti-war movement. Yep. It was a bunch of peaceniks who tricked Netanyahu into pretending that he believed for a minute that Hamas was behind the kidnapping of those three boys and setting upon a policy of coming up with excuses to bomb Gaza and try to break the coalition government that had been created there. In order to distract from all the war party talking points, trying to get us back into Iraq. Remember, that was coming hot and heavy there for a minute, Cheney and all the neocons. Who benefits, man? That's all you need to know. Who benefits? Well, the peace movement benefits. Well, actually, I guess we suffer because the war doesn't happen, so that's good, though. It's the kind of suffering we prefer. Less killing. Less anger about it. But anyway, you understand what I mean. I'm not very funny, but I'm trying to just joke around that, you know, I don't know. Things could be a hell of a lot worse, don't you think? If the war party really wanted to go back to Iraq, could it be that at the Pentagon, the people running the place really don't want to go back there? Because it would seem to me that they do. But I don't know. There's the problem that the American media now admits. I don't know if the American people really understand this now. But the American media now admits for partisan Israeli reasons, really, that, yeah, it's true. The government that America installed in power in Baghdad is very close with Iran. And do we really want to fight on their side? Now, it's funny that they would have us consider Iran an enemy of the American people in the same way that Al-Qaeda is an enemy of the American people. It's absolutely ridiculous, but anyway, point being, at least they're honest now about who they were fighting for before, and according to their talking points, fighting on the same side as Iran on anything is a horrible idea because Iran is pure evil. Now, to me, it's a horrible idea because it's already, America's already made a Sunni-Shia civil war over there. It's an Iranian-Saudi proxy war, and it's a sectarian war, and it's a damn mess over there. And we don't need to be back in the Mujahideen any more than we need to be back in Iran or vice versa either. With all your vices. Support for murderers. And, you know, the Iranian-backed factions in Iraq, by the way, those guys are monsters. You know, the Badr Brigade and even the Mahdi Army, which you'll hear me say things that sound kind of conciliatory toward Sadr sometimes, but I'm really not. I mean, the guy is he's soaked in blood all the way up past the crown of his head, past the top of his turban. He's a mass murderer. The only thing I like to say about him is to point out that he wanted a coalition government with the Sunni Arab Iraqis against Iran and America. And America preferred the Iran factions just because they would let us stay for a while. They needed our help to take Baghdad, where Sadr wasn't trying to take it. And then when it came down to it, he got involved in the worst of the civil war, and his Mahdi army killed a lot of people in the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad, you know, 2 years later, 3 years later. But no, the guy's a butcher. The Mahdi army, the so-called different special groups and whatever breakoffs of the Mahdi army, and the Badr Brigade. I mean, these guys are guys, they torture people to death with power drills. Power drills to death. Okay? Power drills through the eyeball. Power drills till you just bleed to death. They're absolute crazy people. And horrible sinners or whatever you want to call them. They're bad men, the people that, Maliki's government. And so the problem isn't that they're backed by Iran. The problem is that they're just horrible people. And the problem is that they're Shia. And to take the Shia side against the Mujahideen at this point is just as bad, again, as I was trying to say, as back in the Mujahideen, as America is still doing in Syria right now. On the other side of what used to be the border there before the Islamic State was declared. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And obviously, there's so much news to cover here. I got to try to move fast. I did have a couple serious stories here, didn't I? Iraq and Syria. Where's my Iraq, Syria? There's Coburn from yesterday. 257 killed. That was from the 21st. Anyway, still horrible violence going on there. We did talk about, I talked about yesterday, but it was a split segment, and I think the clock ran out on it. The Islamic State overwhelms Iraqi forces, that is, Maliki Shia forces, at Tikrit in major defeat. They've been fighting for it for, and that's the Iraqi army and along with the Mahdi army, I believe, and the other militias here. And they have retreated and given up on Tikrit, which you could tell, I could tell, couldn't we tell from the very beginning? That was a stupid political posturing decision by Maliki to try to take Tikrit when he does not really have support there. He's, you know, trying to prove something with force that wasn't going to work with just force, not with as much as he's got anyway. So the lines are becoming more solidified, and that doesn't mean they're going to keep fighting. After all, for years they fought World War I over yards on the battlefield, right? Sometimes inches. So, they could still go to war, but it seems to me, and I'm terribly roughly paraphrasing Mitchell Prothro's reporting, and others too, Coburn and others, you know, errors on me, not on them, but it seems like what they're reporting, my interpretation of what they're reporting is that, yeah, Iraq is done. Iraq is done. Even if somehow Assad is able to, Russia and Iran arm Assad so strong that he's able to retake all of what was formerly known as Syria and solidify his power there, still Western and Northwestern Iraq, they're not coming back under the authority of Baghdad. Baghdad's not going to have them, not any kind of way where they would want to come back. It's already all too late. And the Kurds are taking the opportunity. They see the writing on the wall. They're done. They locked down Kirkuk, which is outside of their actual natural hilly region out there in the desert, as Prothro explained, you know, reporting from Erbil. It's a little bit outside their territory, but boy, they want it. They're going to end up, and, you know, I don't know. It remains to be seen whether they'll be able to hold their own against ISIS when the war for Kirkuk finally comes between those two factions, and I don't know how long of a matter of time that is. I'm sure Kirkuk is not on their highest priorities. Then again, it's a lot of oil, and locking down oil facilities sure seems to be a high priority of ISIS. And after all, I mean, without Kirkuk, I mean, this is part of what, as Juan Cole put it back, you know, starting in 2004 to me on the show, there may be oil in Sunni lands, but it's not developed in Sunni Iraq, in the Sunni Triangle or whatever you call it, Anbar and the whatever the other provinces up northwest. The only developed oil resources are near Kirkuk and down near Basra in the far south near Kuwait. And so if their idea was, if they don't control the central government, who's going to guarantee their, in fact, disproportionate share of the oil revenues? That was a big part of what the Baathists were fighting for in the first place. But anyway, and the Sunni population in revolt. But so ISIS, I mean, they have to recognize that, you know, they're broke, really. I mean, they may be the most well-funded terrorist group in the world, but they're one of the poorest governments in the world if they really mean to be the government of this new caliphate that they've claimed. They're going to need a lot more money than they got so far, a lot more than Saudi donors are going to be able to provide. So they're going to have to pump a hell of a lot of oil. Man, it's crazy. I don't know. I guess I still... You know what? I was wrong about Libya, too. I mean, obviously, the place has gone completely to hell. And America has been, you know, pseudo-involved there for a while, training some troops, and CIA's there, and they have a sock puppet now. It seems like he must be a CIA sock puppet still trying this coup now. That's my assumption. I don't know. Maybe not. Haftar. But the place is in chaos. But I said back when I was trying to tell you not to go to war in Libya back in 2011, I says, hey, man, once you break it, you bought it. That's what we learned from Iraq. That's the way the empire looks at it. And when they overthrow the commie colonel, and, well, not that he was really a commie. I know actual communists would be mad at me for calling Gaddafi a communist, but he was a secularist. And much more of a socialist than any kind of Islamist or anything. Again, with the clean shave and the war against Islamists from Benghazi and so forth in the past. But I said, once you overthrow him, you turn the place over into chaos. There's no state there to just put a new head on top of it. You'll have to rebuild the entire state from nothing, build a whole army. Next thing you know, democracy, purple-fingered elections. They'll stand up, we'll stand down. And I never thought we'd have made it to 2014 with this little American involvement in Libya. I said then we'll own it for 20 years. Now, we're not done owning it yet. I mean, from the government's point of view, owning, you understand. They are heavily involved, but it could be so much more. You know, like Iraq-style, Afghanistan-style training missions for their army and that kind of thing. And maybe once Haftar, if Haftar is able to seize power, maybe they will train him up an army that much. But anyway, point is, I was wrong about the level of American involvement in Libya after the war. I thought it'd be a lot more by now. And so maybe I'm wrong, you know. I try not to be too alarmist, but I just can't figure out how are they going to not bomb Iraq? I mean, in a major kind of way. See, I was going to be done talking about Iraq, and now I hear still going on and on. I got Gaza and Ukraine stuff coming up. But I don't know if it can even wait for Bush or Hillary. I think at some point, or I don't know. I mean, the American people are so over it. The American people do not want to fight about it. But I don't know if that is going to be able to stop the government. I don't know. Am I wrong? You know, have Osama bin Laden a stand and they're going to not go to war against it. I mean, cool. If the American people are that anti-war now, I guess I just missed it. I mean, part of it is having Barack Obama as commander-in-chief, right? That really undercuts support for the war party by their usual rank and file, the right-wing populists, you know? That, you know, what mission would you send Barack Obama to go accomplish for you? Yeah, good point. Never mind. You gonna give your boy over to Barack Obama for his best judgment to use? As a foot soldier, as cannon fodder in somebody else's war? I don't think so. Get that kind of thing with Democrats in power a little bit. Helps undercut support for this kind of adventurism. But, I don't know. Anyway, that's what I'm afraid is going to happen, is that there's going to be a full-scale bombing campaign in Iraq, and then it's going to generate even more terrorist attacks against the United States. Just like it has done since the 1990s, the very early 1990s.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Again, coming up, Michael Scheuer, former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, and Gareth Porter from Interpress Service. All right. So here, let me talk about Ukraine. The first thing I have to say about Ukraine is that you are not going to hear a lot of declarative statements. Because I don't really know. The plane crash. But I had heard lots of different things. I kind of want to try to go over some of them with you. For what it's worth. I think the most important thing to get to, first of all, is the Associated Press article here. Well, let me find out. I forget now what was their... what was the AP headline before I go on here? U.S. officials, no evidence of direct Russian link to shoot down, to Malaysia plane crash. All right. This show has an old friend. This show's old friend, Vineyard Saker. Used to blog at Stress for a while there. Vineyardsaker.blogspot.se. He calls it the most pathetic case of backpedaling I have seen in my life. And if you just go to, again, vineyardsaker.blogspot.se, you can find it. And he just goes through and does some bolding and some red to highlight all of the new weasel words as of, you know, last night, the 22nd of July. After, you know, almost a full week, 6 days of propaganda from the United States, they backpedal as almost never before here. Senior U.S. officials said Tuesday that Russia was responsible for creating the conditions that led to the shooting down of Malaysia Air Flight 17, but they offered no evidence of direct Russian government involvement. The intelligence officials were cautious in their assessment, noting that while the Russians have been arming separatists in eastern Ukraine, the U.S. has no direct evidence that the missile used to shoot down the passenger jet came from Russia. The officials briefed reporters Tuesday under ground rules that their names not be used in discussing intelligence related to last week's air disaster, which killed 298 people. The plane was likely shot down by an SA-11 surface-to-air missile fired by Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine, the intelligence officials said, citing intercepts, satellite photos, and social media postings by separatists, some of which they said had been authenticated by U.S. experts. But the officials said they did not know who fired the missile or whether any Russian operatives were present at the missile launch. They were not certain that the missile crew was trained in Russia, although they described a stepped-up campaign in recent weeks by Russia to arm and train the rebels, which they say has continued even after the downing of the commercial jetliner. In terms of who fired the missile, quote, "We don't know a name." Listen, this is the intelligence officials, quoted by AP, climbing down from all their accusations, from many of their accusations about this downing of the Malaysian flight over eastern Ukraine. They were not certain that the missile crew was trained in Russia. Nope, I'm on the wrong paragraph. In terms of who fired the missile, quote, "We don't know a name, we don't know a rank, and we're not even 100% sure of a nationality," one official said. Adding at another point, "There is not going to be a Perry Mason moment here. They don't know who did it, and they never are going to come up with evidence of who did it," is what he just said. That's what that means, the Perry Mason moment. The, you are so busted, you're busted. What are you going to do? Perry Mason has got your ass. That, for those of you who are young and you're not familiar with Perry Mason, he's like Matlock. Oh, you might not know who Matlock is either. He's a fictional defense lawyer on TV who always wins because he's smarter than everybody else.
There is not going to be a Perry Mason moment here, he says. White House Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes says the U.S. was still working to determine whether the missile launch had a direct link to Russia. In other words, they got nothing. Whether there were Russians on the ground during the attack, which would be the explanation for how could these so-called rebels be able to operate machinery like this, assuming they actually even had any. And including whether there were Russians on the ground during the attack, and the degree to which Russians may have trained these separatists. We do think President Putin and the Russian government bears responsibility for the support they provided these separatists. The arms. No, they're not saying these missiles. They're saying, you know, just arming them in general, which is still just an assertion. And hiding behind think instead of know. And, you know, the general unstable environment in eastern Ukraine. He added that heavy weaponry continues to flow into Ukraine from Russia following the downing of the plane. He asserted that. The intelligence official said the most likely explanation for the downing was that the rebels made a mistake. By the way, and this is what I meant to say in the first place, that's what I thought. I don't know what I think now. But that was the obvious thing, right? Was these guys got their hands on a missile and they shot it at a Ukrainian government plane, which after all had been bombing the hell out of them, and oops, just because they can fire the missile doesn't mean they know how to pick their target well. That's plausible, right? That seemed to me the most plausible. Second place most plausible would be, or I don't know, tied for second place to me would be some Russian pilot screwed up and shot down the wrong plane or something like that. At least they would have the capability to do so. And then I guess I have to put that second accident on the Russians' part second. But then I guess in third place would be that the Ukrainian government shot it down. And I guess that could have been an accident somehow too, although I don't know how they would have thought they were shooting down a rebel plane. I mean, the accusation would be they shot it down to try to blame it on the rebels. Now that seems... Look, that is not the simplest explanation, right? Come on. The simplest explanation is the rebels screwed up. However, there's more to... That was at least my position in the first place. That was my gut instinct in the first place. I guess I'll leave that at that for now. The most likely explanation, that's what they say. The officials make clear they're relying in part on social media postings and videos made public in recent days by the Ukrainian government, even though they have not been able to authenticate all of it. For example, they cited a video of a missile launcher said to have been crossing the Russian border after the launch, appearing to be missing a missile. But later, under questioning, officials acknowledged they had not yet verified that the video was exactly what it purported to be. Despite the fuzziness of some details, however, the intelligence officials said the case that the separatists were responsible for shooting down the plane was solid. Other scenarios, such as, again, this is the AP on a briefing by U.S. intelligence officials climbing down from all of John Kerry and Samantha Power's hyperbole here, basically. Other scenarios, such as the Ukrainian military shot down the plane, are implausible, they said. No Ukrainian surface-to-air missile was in range. Oh, music's playing? Damn it. All right, well, I'll be back in a minute with more of this. And they say there are no Ukrainian surface-to-air missiles in range. That is a point of fact which is in dispute. But anyway, caveat words, Vineyard Sager says he counts 15 maybes and could-bes, and we might think so's if we feel like possibly...
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, anyway, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and, you know, I appreciate this. I'm not sure why, it just rings true to me. Vineyard Saker,
I'm not sure which country. Maybe he's written now. It used to be kind of a secret, but he's a former military and or intelligence official from Eastern Europe somewhere, and I think perhaps from Russia. And he says here, look, I'm in this game 100% on Russia's side. Don't get me wrong. I mean, what the hell? He's being upfront about that. But he's saying he's not speaking as a, you know, more pro-Russian point of view here as much as he's speaking from a former intelligence officer point of view. That, man, it is so unfair the way the Democrats treat the CIA. Well, and the Republicans too, you know, he cites here Colin Powell's dishwasher powder in a vial at the UN, what if this was anthrax? Saddam has anthrax and all this crap. But he's just saying, you know, over and over again, look at the Syria thing last summer, for example. You have the politicians come out and say, the CIA tells us that all these things are true. But, you know, the CIA, yeah, it's pure evil and all that. But they're still individuals. And there are guys who work in specific analyst offices, you know, in specific hallways there at their campuses or whatever, who have specific jobs. And that's got to really suck all the time when every time John Kerry lies, he goes, yeah, because that's what Bob told me, you know, and they got to take the rap for it. And so it makes them out to be unprofessional. And so here's a ex-professional level intelligence guy saying, hey, man, this is really not fair to the guys who are trying to work hard and tell you the truth there, pals. But, you know, that's what Robert Perry said was, hey, man, CIA, well, he didn't say CIA. He said he had a source who says that CIA analysts, so maybe it was one degree of hearsay kind of thing going on there, but that it was in dispute. They had found a missile launcher, but they weren't so sure it was the rebels there. They thought, in fact, that it was the Ukrainians there, the missile launchers. And then here's the other thing. And I admit that my attention was divided when this thing was on. I had so much stuff going on here this morning. But I finally got a chance to watch this morning the Russian military's press conference about this. And so they bring up a question. And chat room, guys, if you know the answer, let me know. Because I just admit that I am way behind on this crap. But why was it so far off course? I heard in the first place that it was because there was a thunderstorm. That was the original reporting. Obviously, that could be a great cover story. But it raises the question, and maybe it's a bogus question, I don't know. Maybe it's just Russian propaganda, I don't know. But they were, you know, making it seem like, yeah, so who told them to fly south instead of the usual route? Who put them closer to dangerous territory? And why do they do it? So that was what I heard, was it was bad weather. That was the original story. I don't know if that's been debunked. I don't know if there's been other explanations or if there's been no plausible explanation we've heard yet from officials or what. But anyway, so that was one of the Russians' points that they made here. And then they show satellite footage. Now you could say to me, hey, Scott Horton, those satellite pictures could be of somewhere in Russia. We don't know. Those satellite pictures could have been made on a contract by Disney Industrial Light and Magic. We don't know. And I will concede that. However, with a caveat, which is that, I don't know. Not really. When people lie about what their satellite photos show, they tend to not show them. It's too easy to be called out. There are too many other professionals in the satellite business, satellite picture business around the world. George H.W. Bush and James Baker never broke out the satellite pictures. They didn't bring out fake satellite pictures. They just didn't show the satellite pictures of the pretended Iraqi divisions awaiting orders to invade Saudi Arabia back in 1990, for example. But, you know, when Adlai Stevenson said, blam, here's the pictures right here of the missiles in Cuba, at the UN, everybody went, whoa, hey, I guess you got us. And I'm trying to think. There was another example the other way where the Russians proved something about American satellite pictures. In other words, it's too easy to dispute, I think, if they put out a fake picture. And I believe, as far as I can tell, again, I'm not perfect on this, but as far as I can tell, the Americans don't have a response to that. They haven't released their satellite footage. Pictures. They say, yeah, we have pictures of the missile launcher in the hands of the rebels. Well, show it then. The Russians are saying, well, we don't have that, but we do have this, and they're showing pictures. Anyway, it's sort of like, I think there's a market test of credibility on this level that I'm not saying it's completely 100% prohibitive that they would ever use fake satellite pictures, but I think there are many powerful incentives against them doing so. You understand what I mean? They come up with a fake picture. John Kerry comes right out and goes, that's fake. Here's the real picture and you're a liar. And the Norwegians and the Australians and the Zimbabweans and the Chinese can all vouch for me too. I got the real pictures and they all know you're lying too. And they, you know what I mean? It doesn't make sense for the Russians to make it up. And they also claim that there's a second plane. And they claim to prove it with radar data and whatever that I can't pretend to understand exactly. I mean, they show some pictures. But if it's fake, you know, show me where it's been debunked that there was a second plane in the air at the time. And they identify it. They say it was a Ukrainian fighter jet. Is that true? By the way, two Ukrainian fighter jets were shot down today by the Ukrainians. Man, you can shoot down a jet, a fighter jet, with a shoulder-fired missile? Really? Those are some badass stingers. I did not realize that you were supposed to be able to hit a at least near Mach flying plane with one of those things, a fighter, you know? Anyway, low-flying transports or something like that, that's one thing. Helicopters. Anyway. And then, so the Russians say, show us the satellites. And that is not a comprehensive recap of the entire Russian presentation, but I think I hit the important points of it, for the most part, anyway. And they're just saying, hey. And unlike John Kerry up there saying, we know this and we know that and a bunch of crap, they're saying, well, yeah, it raises the question of what was going on there. You know what I mean? Anyway. You know, I have it on MSNBC for some reason, but I should have it on CNN today. I only thought of this just now that's what I've been watching for the last couple of weeks. And so I really should be watching to see what, if any, change there is in the way that they're covering it, you know? Now that the American intelligence officials have climbed down from so many of their assertions about how, well, geez, you know, how could the Ukrainian rebels have snuck a weapon in there like that and then got rid of it so fast? And yeah, we can't really stand by any of the evidence that we said proved that. Oh, how could a bunch of guys with no training do it? I know, it must have been the Russians that helped them do it. Actually, yeah, we cannot stand by any assertion that there were any Russians who trained these guys to be able to use weapons like this, or that they were in the country. Yeah, we don't have a shred of anything about that. Yeah, and so, yeah. Now, I don't know if the reporters, apparently the AP reporters and the other reporters here, I don't know, did any of them ask about the second plane? You guys going to climb down on whether or not there was a second plane? You got to wonder, why are they lying, the Ukrainian government, saying there was no second plane if there was a second plane? Was there a second plane? I don't know. And yeah, by the way, I'm no fan of Putin. I mean, really, personally, I really don't care. But the wife, she hates him. She's Ukrainian. And she hated him long before any of this stuff. And he is like a horrible right-wing Republican type, you know? So, whatever. But he's not the enemy of this country. His government's not the enemy of this country. And the U.S. government continues to expand NATO, continues to pick this fight. Oh, that's one of the points I wanted to get back to. I saw Gawker, they were mocking Ron Paul for saying, didn't America help create the atmosphere here? But he's only turned that talking point around. That, well, the Russians are meta responsible for this entire thing, but it was America who did the coup d'etat in February and used a bunch of Nazis to do it. So, it's hardly the recreation of the Soviet Union, it's a reaction to that. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, interviews. That's right, interviews on The Scott Horton Show. All right. Yeah, you know what? There was one more thing. Well, no, I'm going to change the subject. Rand Paul says no one should question Israel. They have the right to defend themselves. I guess we'll get back to Gaza in a second. And then, but he says America should impose harsh sanctions on Russia. You know, in the case of if the rebels accidentally shot down this plane thinking they were defending themselves from the Ukrainian coup d'etat government that America put in power there, that had been killing them from the air, you know. In that case, Paul advocated, reports Politico, to impose harsh sanctions on Russia and quickly develop alternatives for Europe's natural gas. Oh, yeah, exactly. Because there's so many alternatives to just completely replace whatever zillion tons of natural gas they get from Russia every year. Anyway, Rand Paul is a kook and a major disappointment. And then his thing on Gaza. Yeah, I mean, what do you expect? What's he gonna do? If Netanyahu nuked Gaza, Rand would come out about his concern that the radiation might blow back on the poor innocent Israelis, who were, of course, you know, provoked by rocket fire into using nukes. That was a hypothetical if you tuned in late. I wasn't claiming that happened. Just, okay, yeah. Oh, Rand Paul. Anyway, and here's what's funny is Jennifer Rubin goes after him anyway. Jennifer Rubin hates his guts anyway. In fact, why? Because he had Michael Scheuer's book on his website and took it down. So there you go. Yeah, Michael Scheuer, boy, I guess that just really discredit. What? Huh? He has a book by the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit about Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and what they're after and how to kill him? Huh. That does sound pretty controversial. But yeah, there you go. He also pulled his father's book, A Foreign Policy of Freedom, down from his website. Because, you know, it's embarrassingly awesome. So, no matter how bad he sucks up, Jennifer Rubin will never be pleased. And that's his target audience here, right? Sure seems like it. The American people are lining up behind his father's position as he runs from it on virtually everything. When all he has to do is lead. I mean, just look at the Republican Party. Just look at the entire political establishment. They're wrong about everything. They're corrupt on everything. Their arguments are completely hollow on everything. And the American people know it. That's why so many, not enough, that's why so many people instantly loved his father. Because they could tell, here's a guy who's telling me the truth for a change up there. You know? And really means it. So, that's exactly what Rand Paul's not. And you know, they say he's the front runner, but that ain't gonna last. He ain't gonna get within 100 miles of that presidency. He could be a great senator, though. Anyway. Dude, it sucks. Oh, back to... I'm sorry, I'm all out of order here. Back to the goddamn... the Buck missiles. There's this article in The Independent, Andrew Buncombe, who he went to the place in eastern Ukraine where this missile system supposedly was and the road it supposedly drove through the other day and all that kind of thing and last week. And nobody believed that it had been there. Nah, what are you talking about? It's a bunch of crap. He couldn't find any reason to believe. And it wasn't just the eyeball witnesses. What was it? There was another point, too. Anyway, certainly all the eyeball witnesses agreed that we never saw anything like some mobile missile launcher rolling through here. Now, you could make up reasons why someone must have threatened them that they better say that or something, but you'd have to make that up, right? There's no actual reason to believe that. And there's no reason to believe that they fooled this guy. He would have written in here, they seem like they were lying, though. You know what I mean? Instead, he's convinced by the end of this article, it's Malaysia Airlines MH17 crash. Was a Russian-made missile really parked in this quiet square? And again, ever since the beginning, since this happened, I told you that my most likely explanation is that the rebels did it. It was some kind of missile they got their hands on, and it was a mistake, a horrible mistake to make. The Ukrainian government did it and blamed it on the rebels, or in order to blame it on the rebels, is not my favorite theory. But I'm just saying, the Americans' accusations, they just don't seem to be holding up here at all. And when they're saying, yeah, we went and looked at Google Images, and we went and looked at a deleted Twitter entry by we don't know who, that's not very much to go on. But it's another amazing study in American media, right? It doesn't matter how many times this happens, where the government makes major declarative statements about what's going on in other countries, and the entire media gets on board. And I mean, you know, the individuals who make up that media. They just climb on board time and time again. They lied us into war with Iraq. And not only do they lie us into war with Iraq, they lied us into war with Iraq for a year and a half. In the fall of 2001, they said, our policy is regime change. We're in the market for excuses. We're looking to kill Saddam and replace his government with one that we want. So get ready. Following... is 10,000 excuses why we gotta do this thing. It was as obvious as that. As much fair warning as that. We've got a project. Convince you to let us do this. And the media went along with it. They went along with it. Every argument would start with, well, everybody knows that they got the weapons of mass destruction. The only question is, should we get permission from the French and the Russians to defend ourselves from Saddam, or should we just go ahead and go? Yeah, that's some really tough questioning going on there, media, for a year and a half when there's an obvious premeditated murder plot to start an aggressive war going on. Aluminum tubes, no one even pretended that yes, and we believe that Saddam has a facility full of aluminum tubes that are in fact spinning centrifuges, enriching weapons-grade uranium to make a bomb to kill us. Nobody even went that far. They just said, aluminum tube that, you know, if you imagine real hard, isn't for rockets, even though we know it's for rockets. It could be a centrifuge, couldn't it? Come on, let us have a war. Media, what did they learn from that? Nothing. And they lied about the entire Iraq war. Like I was saying earlier, they only now admit that it's the Iranian-backed parties that America has put in power in Baghdad. Well, they don't put it that way. But somehow, mysteriously, it's Iran's best friends who are in power in Baghdad now. But they never told you. That's what our project is. That's who we're fighting for. You know, even Keith Olbermann right? Never said, hey, everybody, that dastardly dastard George Bush is putting the Supreme Islamic Council in power. Well, who are they? Here's a short PowerPoint presentation. Nope, never happened. Not once. Not ever. On TV news. They lied that whole time. And then look at Syria, where the much more likely explanation is, in fact, that the Turks and the al-Nusra Front al-Qaeda franchise did it just to give America an excuse to bomb Assad. As reported by the best reporter in America, Seymour Hersh, you know. But, oh well, you know what? I bet all their assertions about this are right. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Coming up, Michael Scheuer, Grant Smith, Gareth Porter, none of whom are libertarians, but I am. But anyway, they all have stuff to say. Important stuff, so stay tuned for that. It's coming up. And really, I think none of them, the Scheuer interview may end up here, but none of the interviews are going to be focusing on the situation in Gaza. So I'm sorry for putting it off, man. I just had it up to here. Let me refresh antiwar.com, get the latest death toll for you there. 665 Gazans. 31 Israelis dead. Gazans, 31 Israelis killed. As far as I know, that's virtually all invading soldiers rather than, civilian casualties of rocket attacks or some crap like that. But anyway, so there you go. 665 Gazans killed so far. And the Israeli envoy says that the IDF deserves the Nobel Prize for not killing more people, for their restraint as they're invading, as they've killed more children than Hamas fighters. Real children. You know, the screaming kind when you wound them? The dying kind when you wound them to death? And, man, get on Twitter and start following journalists in Gaza and start looking at the pictures they're sending back. It's something else, I'll tell you what, man. And anyway, what the hell, I forget now. I start thinking about all the dead bodies I saw. I forgot what point I really wanted to make about it all. What points? Here's the points. You go with what's wrong with the media coverage. There's this lady, I was trying to get her on the show, but I didn't hear back, unfortunately. But there's this lady, her name is Rula Jibril, and she had a position being some kind of analyst on MSNBC, but they canned her after she called out Andrea Mitchell for having nothing but an Israeli government official love fest all day, every day on her show. And so she did an interview with Chris Hayes last night where she really did a great job of trying to get him to shut up and just let her tell the Palestinian side of the story for a minute then, because that was kind of his question. Well, so what is it people aren't hearing? You know, yeah, something like that. So, and here's the most important point that she said, and I don't know the polling data, but I believe that this is right. In my experience, this is right. Americans don't know that there's an occupation. They don't know. If they've heard of the two-state solution or whatever, but they never sat and thought about it, the 300 million of them, that what that means is they don't have a state now. It means they're basically on giant Indian reservations. And if you think our government is bad to our Indians, which I was just reading the ACLU this morning, you can find this on my Twitter feed. Matthew Harwood put it out. The ACLU is trying to intervene here because they've got some, you know, hamburger factory going on over there where they just take Indians' kids away for nothing all the time and give them no recourse and no process whatsoever. They steal their children all day long. They steal the Indians' children from the reservations. It's at ACLU.org right now. But, you know, you think we treat our Indians bad in the 20th and 21st centuries. You know, look at what the Israelis do to the people of the Gaza Strip. A friend asked me, well, why is it people say that it's a prison? Is it because they're not allowed to leave? Yeah, they're not allowed to leave. There was a story recently about Gazan kids who had studied so hard, they had qualified. Can you imagine growing up in the Gaza Strip and they had qualified for Fulbright scholarships to come to the United States to go to the university? And the Israelis won't let them out of the Gaza Strip. They are prisoners. And they are refugees. 80% of the population of the Gaza Strip, they're refugees from what is now Israel. It never was a land without people for a people without land. That was a lie. See? A lie. Doesn't sound as good when, yeah, we ethnically cleansed 3/4 of a million people from this land into the West Bank and Gaza. Of course, and then they've been occupying the West Bank and Gaza outright since 1967. And what's his name? The guy from 972 blog. I've interviewed him a few times. There's a few people who write there, I know. But the guy that I've talked to a few times, guy's name is just escaping me. A lot of things are escaping me lately. What's the name of that guy? He wrote a thing for Slate where he says, you know, what you need to understand is the West Bank and East Jerusalem, it's, you know, more or less, it's a minimum security prison. And Gaza is a maximum security prison. That's what it is. And in that sense, Hamas are the guards. Hamas basically work for Israel. They're certainly not the, maybe they're the most powerful gang in the prison. If the Israelis are the actual, you know, government security guards. But they, you know, Americans don't understand that. They don't know that. And as she points out, the entire world sides with the Palestinians, except in America. And what's the difference? It's not because we're righteous and the whole world is in darkness and evil and turmoil and wants to kill all good Jews. That's not the answer. The answer is because they lie to Americans all damn day long about the context. They lie by omission. They don't ever say, not on the Chris Hayes show or anywhere else, do they put up a map of Israel and Palestine and say, see, this is the occupied territory. They don't really have their own government so much as they have the Shin Bet, which is the Israeli National Secret Police, and they have the Israeli Defense Forces, their army, occupying them under permanent martial law where they have no rights at all. Okay? That's what the occupied territories are. That's what the places are where these rockets are coming up over the wall, see? So it's not, as Americans believe, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to be patronizing to people in the audience who obviously know all this crap, but, you know, how am I supposed to strike this balance? It's difficult. She's making the point, and she's absolutely right. Americans don't understand the occupation. I got in an argument with some right-wingers on there, and they're saying, all the Israelis do is give up land, and every time they do, all they get in return is terrorism. That is just so stupidly opposite of the truth. All the Israelis do is take and take and take and take land. What is he talking about? They gave Sinai back to Egypt back 30, 40 years ago. Big effing deal, man. They are occupying the people of Gaza and the West Bank, and they're colonizing the West Bank. They call it Judea and Samaria, and we're keeping it, they say. We're annexing it eventually, they say, for greater Israel, they say. It's the Israelis who deny the Palestinians their right to exist as an autonomous state, which, of course, is not the highest end of humanity. It's the individual, but still, you understand the point. That's what Americans don't understand. That's what they have to be taught, is that, hey, there is an occupation, okay? If Fort Worth invaded Dallas and enslaved the people of Dallas, we would expect them to shoot back. Wouldn't justify if they killed a civilian, but at least we would understand what the hell was going on.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest on the show today is Michael Scheuer. He's the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, and he keeps a website at non-intervention.com, non-intervention.com, and he's the author of the books, Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Marching Toward Hell, Imperial Hubris, and the biography Osama bin Laden. Welcome back to the show, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm good, Scott. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Very happy to have you here on the show. And listen, something I remember reading in your books and something we talked about in the past is the role of Israel and their foreign policy in generating terrorist attacks against the United States. So I guess, first of all, could you explain why in the world those things are even connected at all? I don't see them attacking Russia or Sweden based on what Israel's doing, and then secondarily, I would have you provide every example you can possibly think of to prove your case.
Well,
if you could, please.
the relationship between us and the Israelis, at least in the Muslim mind, is the relationship of extraordinary closeness. The belief today, for example, in the Muslim world is that the Israelis are attacking in Palestine because the Americans said it was fine to do it. And, of course, the Israelis moved in, and we've been very vocal in saying that the Israelis can do whatever they want to do. And, Mayor Bloomberg goes to Israel to show American support for them, giving the impression that all of America loves being on the hook for what the Israelis do. And it's a very widespread, very deeply held belief that we are, Israel is our outpost in the region, and we're going to use it to expand into other Muslim countries. And it's something that is raised constantly by our enemies, by Osama bin Laden in particular. And it is a fatal association for the United States. There's nothing good that can come out of it. From a purely foreign policy perspective, we don't need the Israelis. There's nothing they have that we need. There's nothing they have that we want. They can simply disappear as far as we're concerned, and it wouldn't hurt us one bit. Ditto for the Palestinians. Two more unimportant countries to the United States than Israel and Palestine are pretty hard to imagine.
From the point of view of the United States government.
From the point of view position. of United States interests, I don't think it matters who the government is.
Right. But you're saying, obviously separate from the sentiment of individual people who don't want to see anybody fight, right?
Well, and individual Americans who are more loyal to the Israelis than to America.
Well, let me ask you this. Before we get all into the details here, which I really want to do, what if it wasn't a matter of the occupation? Because that's the obvious thing, right? Is 20 years plus in occupying southern Lebanon and now, 45 years in occupying the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, and these periodic, completely one-sided wars. But what about accepting the Nakba as a fact of life and just within 48 or, 67 borders maybe, and then try to go from there and make peace from there? Would America, and America still had its relationship with Israel, would America still suffer terrorist attacks for that? Or is it a matter of, just Israel's existence? Or is it a matter of, really their periodic operations, Grapes of Wrath, or whatever they call them, and they go around killing everybody?
I think it's the relationship is such that they're killing Palestinians with U.S.-made weaponry, with U.S. funds. I think that's the problem. I have no particular interest in the Palestinians. So many of people who identify themselves as non-interventionists or isolationists believe you have to be pro-Palestinian to be a non-interventionist. The definition should be to not care one way or another. I think the Israelis, what they're doing right now is exactly what they should be doing, if that's what they believe they should be doing. They do have every right in the world to defend themselves however they want to defend themselves. They have no right to exist. We have no right to exist. That's just something that was made up by the Israeli lobby and the politicians to it sounds good if you say it fast, but ultimately it's meaningless. Or we would be bringing back, you know, Latin Jerusalem, and we would be bringing back the Soviet Union. They all had a right to exist if Israel has a right to exist. So I think you've got to drop that. I think for the United States, the beginning of wisdom is just to realize that if we're going to continue the relationship with the Israelis with the way it has been, then that's fine. If we believe that is key to the United States defense and foreign policy in the region, then we have to do that. But we also have to be adults. Every action has a reaction. And the reaction to our unfailing support for Israel is dead Americans and the growth of anti-American animosity among 1.4 billion Muslims. That's just the fact. There's no other country on earth that could have gotten away with 17 days now or 16 days of unlimited bombardment of civilians. The whole world is cowed by you know, the memories of the Holocaust and all of the rest of the crap the Israelis use to get people to do things their way. And I just don't think that America deserves or merits the punishment that comes from a relationship that at the end of the day means nothing to our national security, economic development, or political well-being.
All right, now, I guess we could talk about the, you know, September 11th and bin Laden, but really the terrorist war against the United States, like, you know, the post-Cold War terrorist war, did it start with the World Trade Center bombing, or I guess the assassination of Rabbi Kane, but that's not so much terrorism, but this is the same group that did it, right? But so, you know, if we go back to the beginning of the 90s, was that all about Israel's policy in Palestine? Ramzi Youssef and the first World Trade Center bombing?
Certainly Ramzi was. And one of the reasons Ramzi Youssef never joined with Al-Qaeda because he believed Al-Qaeda did not have enough emphasis on Israel and Palestine. The same thing with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. For years, he steered clear of official membership in Al-Qaeda because Al-Qaeda was not interested or not active enough against the Israelis. And that's just the way it is. But since bin Laden came on the scene and focused the Muslim world on the United States as an enemy, Israel has been on one of the top members of the list of grievances they've had against us. And it's played very, very well. If you look at the expansion of the Islamist insurgency, the Sunni Islamist insurgency, from 2001 or from 1996 until today, it's an enormous expansion. It keeps growing and growing and growing. And it's because bin Laden focused on substance and not rhetoric, not nonsense like the reestablishment of the caliphate or things like that. He talked about very specific substantive issues, and the Muslim world has been focused on those since. And we continue to play the foil. The Al-Qaeda exists. Al-Qaeda and its allies exist. The Islamist movement exists because they have us to play the fool. And as long as we do that, we're going to be on their bullseye.
Mm. All right, so then I guess if we go through... Well, I don't know. Can you describe, was it Khalid Sheikh Mohammed became friends with Osama because Osama finally said, yes, we want to put a priority on Palestine? Is that it?
No, I think, you know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed put in with Al-Qaeda simply because they had the most capability to attack the United States.
Well, surely in 1996, bin Laden's fatwa against the Jews and Crusaders, as it's called, focuses on the Qana massacre and Operation Grapes of Wrath in southern Lebanon at, you know, some length. Oh, now
yes.
The music's playing, Mike, and we got to take this break. I'm sorry. When we get back, more with Michael Scheuer, author of Imperial Hubris, Osama bin Laden, Marching Toward Hell Through Our Enemy's Eyes. He's at nonintervention.com. We're talking about the role of American support for Israel in generating terrorist attacks against the United States.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about commodity discs from commoditydiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Michael Scheuer. He's formerly the chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, Alex Station. And he's the author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, and many others. Now, I'm sorry. When we were leaving off, I was mentioning about Bin Laden's fatwa of 1996, where he cited Israel and southern Lebanon and, of course, in Palestine. And then I was also going to, since I mentioned that before the break, I'll add to it that in Terry McDermott's book, Perfect Soldiers, he says that Mohammed Atta and Ramzi bin al-Shib would sit around all day at the Hamburg apartment talking about how Americans should pay for what Israel was doing in Palestine and in Lebanon. And I guess in Lawrence Wright's book, he says that Atta filled out his last will and testament as a symbolic act, basically joining up the war on their side against us during Operation Grapes of Wrath in 1996 in southern Lebanon. Is that right?
I think that's probably exactly right. There are those any number of those anecdotes, but I think the important thing is to look
at... Well, I mean, and he's the lead hijacker, or yeah. You're telling me he's the lead hijacker, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it kind of matters.
Well, it does. It does matter, but it's just common sense in many ways. If we're backing someone who routinely kills Arabs when they feel necessary to do so, it doesn't take the anecdotes that you just related. It doesn't take what Osama bin Laden says to make a person believe that at some point there's going to be a response to that, Scott. Mm. And the service that Osama bin Laden provided was to focus the Muslim world on that, and especially our role in it. Immediately after 9/11, the neocons and the pro-Israeli media in this country attacked bin Laden as someone who came to the issue of Palestine only after 9/11, as a Johnny-come-lately, and saying that that could not possibly have been one of his motivations for ordering the attack on us on 9/11. The reality of it is, if you go to August 1996 and go to his declaration of war on the United States, the issue of Palestine and Israel is mentioned at least a dozen times in the course of a dozen pages. And throughout the 90s and into the early 2000s, one of the primary focuses of his discussion about the how the West treats Muslims as if their blood was worthless was the Israeli massacre of the people at those two refugee camps, Shatila and I can't remember the other one,
Sandra,
in Lebanon.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so this is not something we need I think this is not something that we really need to wonder if it's true or if it's false or how much evidence you can have on either side. The evidence plainly is overwhelming. Mm-hmm. The common sense is plainly overwhelming. Sure. And the problem for Al-Qaeda was not that it didn't want to attack the Israelis, but because it's not a terrorist group, but rather an insurgency, it had no footing. It had no contiguous territory from which to attack the Israelis, which is now changing thanks to what we did in Iraq. The Bush's war in Iraq is, for the Islamists, just a gift that keeps giving. Once Syria goes, then goes Jordan. And all of a sudden, the Mujahideen are now have moved westward 1,000 miles from Afghanistan, and not only in Iraq, but they're on the borders of Israel. And nuclear weapons are very good things to intimidate foreign countries, but they're not much when it comes to border control. And within the next 3 or 4 years, the Islamist insurgency, whether it's Al-Qaeda or any of the other myriad of groups that are out there, are going to be right on Israel's border, on the Egyptian border and on the other border. Mm-hmm. And that's a big problem. And we're in a spiral now where ultimately if we continue this relationship with the Israelis, we're going to have to field troops in that area to help them protect themselves, because the problem is going to become overwhelming for them.
Well, and they've already drawn the line at Jordan that Israel will invade Jordan to protect the Hashemite kingdom there. And, of course, America would beat them to it in order to keep them out of it, probably, in that case, right?
Well, we would try to do it, but clearly we have less than 200,000 shooters in our army, Scott. What the American people don't realize is what Obama and Bush, especially Obama, have done to the American military. We're going to have 450,000 soldiers in the army. One in three of them are shooters, so it's much less than 200,000 are going to be shooters. What are we going to do with those people? And as soon as the Israelis move against Jordan, the whole concept in the Muslim world that Israel's goal has been this thing called Greater Israel, from the Nile to the Euphrates. As soon as they move into Jordan or into Syria, that becomes activated, and the animosity across the Muslim world toward the Israelis and toward us becomes enormously bigger. This is a lose-lose-lose situation for the United States. The only way out of it is to say good luck to the Israelis and protect American interests first. This is a cancer. This is a bleeding wound on the United States. And eventually, also, we're going to face the problem of what impact our policy toward Israel has on our Muslim population in the United States. And it's not going to be a good reaction. There's no reason to assume that the young men in the United States, the young Muslims, are not just as influenced as young Muslims in Egypt or Pakistan or Syria are by our unquestioning support for the Israelis.
Well, so far, they travel over there to fight. The Somali Americans, that kid from Florida from a few months back, but it's true that could change. But the last time we talked, it was just a few weeks ago, and yet in the meantime, the caliphate has been declared, the one that you and I were predicting on that show, that the lawless land between Syria and Iraq is becoming, it has a law now. It's the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. And I was saying, and I'm afraid we're going to go back to war against them, because how can the American politicians resist? Now that has gone ahead and come to fruition, you don't really want to field an army there, do you? I mean, you want to cut off everything, but so what if we can't stop back, and, you know, politically in America, in real life, we cannot get the government to stop back in the Israelis, but we can get them to not attack ISIS. I'm sorry, Mike.
Obviously,
even if we leave ISIS alone and we're still back in Israel, then we're still generating a problem, even though not necessarily as bad a one as if we outright were attacking them. But anyway.
Scott, we are in the almost the same position that we were in when we first talked, which must now be nearly a decade ago.
Yeah.
We still have a political class in this country and a media class that absolutely refuses that anything to believe or to at least say or admit that anything we do in our foreign policy could possibly motivate this enemy against us. We haven't taken a step forward. And until we take a step forward and become adults, we're not going to be able to deal with the problem. I would say our support for Israel is right up there with our support for a tyranny like the Saudi tyranny or like the Jordanian tyranny, and our support for the overthrow of a democratically elected government in Egypt and its replacement by a military dictatorship. Those are all actions which add to the animus toward us.
Yeah.
And I'm still not one, you know, you can declare a caliphate all you want. You may have a government that can run the area in Syria and Iraq at some point in the future, but the idea that there's going to be a worldwide caliphate, given that the leader has to be an Arab and Arabs are a minority in a small minority, really, in the Islamic world, I think that's not a worry. That's a hobgoblin that the neocons and the right use to scare people. I think the real issue for us is accepting that this enemy is out there and that we motivate it, and we have really two choices. We can either adjust our foreign policy to discourage their interest in us and increase their interest in killing each other, Sunnis versus Shias, or destroying the governments in the region and trying to reestablish new ones, or we can maintain the foreign policy that we have and end up having to kill unlimited numbers of those people if we want to survive. This is an existential threat to the United States, not only in terms of economic welfare, but in terms of our own domestic civil liberties and civil rights. And we've seen that already. It's because we continue to function on the basis of a refusal to accept the reality that we motivate our enemies.
Yeah. Well, and as you say, it's creating what Bin Laden called that choking life that he was trying. That's part of the
exactly.
reaction to his terrorism.
He was trying to impose on us what the Israelis have imposed on the Palestinians.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I can see why you titled that second one, that third one, Marching Toward Hell. Michael, I get it. Appreciate your time on the show as always. That's Michael
Thank
Sawyer,
you.
Everybody, former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, author of the biography Osama Bin Laden. We'll be right back.
Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, so you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Next up on the show today is our friend Grant F. Smith. He runs the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's IRMEP.org, I-R-M-E-P. I-R-M-E-P, IRMEP.org. He's the author of Spy Trade, Deadly Dogma, Divert, Foreign Agents, America's Defense Line, and Visa Denied. I know, that's a lot of books, right? Welcome back to the show, Grant. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back again.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. Tell me, what's the Israel lobby?
What is the Israel lobby? Well, the Israel lobby, as far as definitions, has been defined by Walter Mearsheimer. It's been defined by the Israel lobby itself many times, saying that it doesn't exist. Walt Mearsheimer saying it's a loose coalition of organizations. My definition, sort of working definition, is that it's really an overlapping matrix of organizations, some working in direct coordination with the Israeli government, that extract military, financial, and political resources from America through policy formulation, grassroots and direct lobbying, pressure on media and elites, and direction of rewards and punishments. So my definition is somewhat longer. There are other people who don't even want to call it a lobby as much as a power configuration, but if anything has come out of the, you know, the Israel lobby book that professors Walt Mearsheimer published a while back, it's been at least having a name to kind of talk about this collection of organizations that have a great deal of impact on U.S. Middle East policy. And just to go into it a little bit further, I think if you take apart my definition of overlapping, one of the things that's interesting about Israel lobbying organizations, and my number is that there are about 200 of them that have sort of a very major direct role in trying to influence policy through a variety of means, is you have overlap of key people on multiple boards of directors. You have a lot of common tactics in which if you are looking to find the single organization that sends the most sort of policy elites and press members or members of Congress to Israel, you'll find a lot of them do that. The ADL, the American Israel Education Foundation, other organizations such as Birthright Israel. So, you know, there's sort of a lack of division of labor in the sense that many of them engage in the same tactics to accomplish the same goals. And, you know, some of them are very tightly coordinated with the Israeli government, maintaining offices in Israel and state openly how they coordinate with the government. That would include both AIPAC and the Zionist Organization of America. And they achieve an extremely high return on investment. If you consider that the top 200 organizations raise between $1 billion and $1.4 billion a year coming in, and what's going out of the United States government is $3.5 to $4 billion, it's a pretty high ROI in terms of the total accomplishment of these organizations. I think if you start dicing the data in another way, and kind of looking at the major activity categories of the Israel lobby, you find that policy formulation, basically saying what the U.S. should do because it's in the U.S. interest as opposed to saying just openly it's in Israel's interest, you find AIPAC, the Washington Institute, formerly known as the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the Foreign Policy Initiative, which I think comes up on your show quite a bit, is the new Bill Kristol organization supplanting the previous organization to get us into war with Iraq. I would include JINSA, J Street. You know, these are policy and lobbying organizations. Many organizations, however, including the Zionist Organization of America and the ABL, actually lobby on Capitol Hill. So just because these are policy formulation and lobbying category sort of organizations doesn't mean others don't do it. You have the media pressure and Israel in danger category. I would include certainly the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, the Emergency Committee for Israel, the Israel Project, CAMERA, the Investigative Project on Terrorism, Honest Reporting, and the Anti-Defamation League, which has that as a major part of its program. That's a $54 million in revenue a year organization, whereas, you know, the smaller ones, such as Foundation for Defense of Democracy, raised about $7 million. But you have this whole other arm of leadership development to make sure that there's a large pool of highly educated, motivated, knowledgeable people who are ready to work in U.S. government agencies or as elected representatives all across the United States political system to steer and move U.S. policy in directions favorable to Israel. I would include the Birthright Israel Foundation, the $100 million organization, the Saban Leadership Foundation or Summit, which works with AIPAC and the American Israel Education Foundation. Even Alpha Epsilon Pi, a fraternity, is very interested in seeing its members become the future leaders in the U.S. political system. But then you also have, you know, the straight lobbying junket category, bringing people, elected officials to Israel, the American Israel Education Foundation. It's supposed to be a broadly educational organization. It's got a $46 million a year budget, but it basically only does one thing, and that's bring members of Congress to Israel. They don't even have a website. They failed to provide one to the IRS in each of the past few years. There's no information you can get of their education program. So it's basically a way to bring Congress members on junkets to Israel. And then you have the big transfer organizations. There isn't only the transfer of U.S. tax dollars to Israel, but of course, many organizations that are lobbying on Capitol Hill, but also just collecting and transferring tax-exempt donations to Israel, such as the United Israel Appeal, the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, $114 million. United Israel Appeal is almost $200 million. Friends of the IDF, sending over $70 million to the IDF every year, Hadassah. The Weizmann Institute of Science, which has been heavily involved in nuclear weapons research and development, they get $68 million in transfers from U.S. Donors each year. And every single one of these organizations making up the core 200, which doesn't count the Christian churches or synagogues or anything like that, but just this core 200, along with those organizations, is doing grassroots lobbying constantly. Everyone, whether they claim it or not, in their tax reporting is involved in some level of trying to engender support, sell Israel, brand it as a startup nation, you know, redirect the debates, introduce the terms of the debates, and that sort of thing. So that would be kind of my profile and sizing of the entire sort of matrix of organizations.
All right, everybody. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton, and he's Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy, IRMEP.org, the author of a great many books about the Israel lobby and FOIA sewer extraordinaire. And when we get back, follow-up questions. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Speaking of the Israel lobby, Rand Paul is saying, America needs an Iron Dome system. Maybe we could buy an Iron Dome from you. To protect from what? From who? The hell does America need an Iron Dome for? What is he even talking about? Who gives him these talking points? This fool, I think he didn't get that from the lobby. He's trying to pander to him, but he must have just made that one up because no one else is so stupid. Anyway, welcome back to the show. I'm talking with Grant Smith, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, and I got to say, that's a long list of groups there, and, you know, I was listening pretty carefully, and they sounded all, you know, and you described them all pretty specifically as much as you could, kind of in there, but it was such a long list, I began to wonder at least whether others might wonder, Grant, whether you were just listing every Jewish organization in America. Were you? Are you saying that every Jewish organization in America is part of the Israel lobby? Or you really just went on for 10 minutes listing various organizations who really are about lobbying the people and the people of America and their government to support the Israeli government in its policies?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I didn't mention Jewish federations, the Rabbinical Council of America, the Cantor's Assembly, Maccabee, Reconstructionist Rabbinical Association. Those are all religious organizations that are primarily trying to promote and educate about Jewish life. Some of them do lend their names to the Conference of Presidents of major Jewish organizations, but I would not include any organization that isn't taking a strong and sustained position on U.S. policy toward the Middle East. So if I did, then we would be doing this for a six-hour show, and I would be listing hundreds and hundreds of organizations that don't even report their revenue to the IRS because they're predominantly religious. So, and I also did include, I believe, I have to go back and listen, International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, and I would also include KUFI, Christians United for Israel.
Although, and they're in D.C. this week, right?
It's a big organization, yeah. Lobbying and having dinners honoring Israel and all of that. A gigantic organization, which I find to be extremely problematic because, and even other, Christian organizational critics and editors have asked them for information about how they use the money, and it's not clear how much they bring in or even what they spend it on. So,
how much influence would you estimate that they have? And let me interrupt for just a second. John Hagee from Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, he's the leader of Christians United for Israel,
right.
And it's the hurry up and force Jesus' hand and make him invade and kill everyone so they can go to heaven all at once, where end of the world stuff.
Right.
But how powerful are they, say, compared to AIPAC or, I don't know, something?
I think their influence is overestimated. If you look at the early documents from the 60s and 50s, you see that Israel lobbying organizations were trying to get something like KUFI created, and they're working very hard to spread their message and basically strike a deal in which they would not be proselytized at every Christian organization that was supporting Israel, meaning that they wouldn't, you know, be asked to convert, and that they would sort of, in return, ignore the dispensationalist, hey, all of you have to convert or die type dogma that are at the basis of a lot of these evangelical support organizations' message. So, but I don't think they're that important, actually. They haven't been around as long. They weren't there promoting the foundation of the state. But again, it's extremely hard to research.
Well, what about just as votes? I mean, can they be convinced to come out or stay home over Israel issues? I mean, for example, I think, didn't Tom DeLay threaten George W. Bush to back off of Powell's push for a Palestinian state after September 11th because he said, you'll be a one-term president like your father, I'll turn all the Christians against you?
Yeah, but that's mainly, it's like a lot of, organizations that overstate their influence. When they claim millions and millions of members, what they're basically saying is someone sent their email in or they obtained an email and they'll never take them off their list. So I'm more skeptical than many others about the political impact. I know it's there, but it wasn't there at the creation, and there simply aren't as many organizations lobbying for Israel and putting out solid, work that I've been able to determine. I would be happy, though, to change that, to update the database, so to speak, as soon as I see a more meaningful contribution and higher numbers and higher revenues in those organizations.
Yeah. Well, I guess the vote to support Israel in their attack on Gaza is unanimous, or I don't know if anybody, was just, voted present or maybe wasn't present, but was it all 100 voted? Do you know?
It's a case where you have kind of a strange situation, where you have this absolute support. But I see it more as a function of the fact that all of the resources, organization, and time is favoring the side of the issue that is demanding unconditional support. But the real, I think their real dilemma is the fact that the central claim, and you hear it over and over again, I heard it on, NPR this morning when, basically on Morning Edition, they say our only or most important ally in the Middle East is this, and we're going to have a national security advisor talk about why the U.S. Is supporting the Gaza invasion, blah, blah, blah. But the vacuousness of the argument of Israel as a strategic asset of the United States is really, I think, refuted by the fact of how much it costs to create and sustain that every year. If Israel were an inherently valuable asset to the United States, it wouldn't require, $1.4 billion a year to pump out the message, the propaganda, to put out, as the Israel Project does, speaking points, talking guides. It wouldn't be necessary to dial test the word terror tunnels and then insist that media people and the entire social network use the word terror tunnels so that Americans would think, oh my God, terror tunnels. I think the number of organizations and how hard they have to work really belies this argument that the country is such a valuable asset to the United States and that every dollar sent over there is a benefit to the United States.
Right. Yeah, I mean, hey, it's the proof's in the pudding. You look at how they get us into these things and they lie their asses off. I mean, everybody in the whole world knows. I think even his allies recognize that Netanyahu never really believed or had evidence that Hamas was behind the kidnapping of those three, teenagers. He just decided that he was going to make this his excuse to do what he wanted to do. Simple as that. So,
well,
I can see why it would take a lot of K Street money
to try to overcome the fact that, geez, these people are damn liars as they kill little kids all day.
Right.
They got no real argument. No wonder they have to lie, because they're guilty.
You see it in some of the revenue flows. Some of the highest revenues went into the Israel Project, this propaganda outfit, at precisely the time when people were becoming concerned about Iraq, and it was their guide for convincing Americans and talking about how that invasion was more in the interest of the U.S. than Israel, at precisely the moment where Americans were wondering, hey, you know, who are the people pushing for this, and why is it costing so much? So, you know, something that's inherently intelligent, policy that's inherently beneficial, does not require this level of infrastructure
right.
to promulgate. It's simply, you know, the proof is in the fact that you have this massive lobbying infrastructure. It gets good return on its investment, but it's extremely costly. And it also, we don't have time to talk about this, but most of my books are about some of the illegal things that they have to do to sustain this, which, you know, also are an argument for the fact that none of this, if you have to spy to pass a trade agreement or try to tripwire the U.S. into a war with Iran by obtaining classified documents, that is more argument about the fundamental fact that you're not acting in any sort of broader interest.
Right. Well, and, you know, along with the dishonesty becomes, as this the former analyst at MSNBC explained, the reason the American people are the only people in the world who side with Israel in the polls on this stuff is because they don't ever explain about the facts of the occupation at all. So we make all our decisions. The people, at least, are accept such false premises that they'll go along with, really bad policies under complete, misperceptions of the actual situation. You know, who's supposed to stop the massive Arab juggernaut coming their way? Of course they have the right to defend
right.
themselves, when defending themselves doesn't have anything to do with it at all, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. But, there's a
lot
ignorance.
Of dishonesty and a lot of money to pay for that dishonesty to be thorough enough to inculcate an entire population. It's pretty impressive policy, I got to tell you. They got it together.
That's a lot of money.
If only I had $1 zillion and I could forge a peace lobby that was so single-minded and determined to end this kind of intervention. But anyway, that's
another
way.
Well, you're off to a good start.
Thanks very much,
Brent.
We're way over time, and I'm talking on and on, and I got
to
go. But you're awesome. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Thanks. That's the great Grant F. Smith, everybody. He wrote Visa Denied and America's Defense Line, Foreign Agents Divert. That's the most important one. That's how they stole their nuclear weapons materials from the United States. Deadly Dogma. And also Spy Trade. Look them up at Amazon.com and at IRMEP, IRMEP, IRMEP.org for the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Went a little overtime with Grant Smith. You'll be able to find it in the archives there at ScottHorton.org later on. That was cool. I said, what's the Israel lobby? He talked for 10 minutes about all the different organizations just dedicated to towing the Likud party line in D.C. My God. That was really something else, wasn't it? Oh, man. All right. Anyway, next up is our good friend Gareth Porter. He's an independent historian and journalist from ipsnews.net, primarily. Also writes for Truth Out. Won the Gellhorn Award for his work on Petraeus and McChrystal's death squads in Afghanistan there for truthout.org. And he's the author of the book Manufactured Crisis, The Truth Behind the Iran Nuclear Scare. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Glad to be back.
Good. Very happy to have you here. And I'm doing fine. You started to ask, so I know that you're very concerned. So anyway, hey, listen, last time we talked, you had turned optimist on the Iran nuclear deal. Yeah, Scott Horton, I think actually they might just do this, you said. I'm roughly paraphrasing. And so now we're back. They've got the extension. And, well, you know, I want to know everything you got to say about what's going on.
Yeah, the extension that was agreed to, I think, reflects the underlying reality that they both know that they are going to get an agreement. They have identified the basic outlines of it. They've narrowed the differences to the point where they know it can be negotiated. I mean, they're reasonably confident, I would say very confident, that they can do that. If you look at the remarks, again, I think this was already in my story last time we talked, but the remarks by both John Kerry and Mohammad Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, after their 2 days of talks, really gave away the nature of the present situation, negotiating situation, which is that they both knew that they had arrived at close to a deal. What John Kerry said, which we didn't discuss when we talked about it last time, was, I think, quite revealing. He said that we have not yet identified. Not a direct quote, but a very close paraphrase. We have not yet identified the formula to be used to cover the problem of centrifuge or you know, enrichment capability. And that's significant because he meant that they really have narrowed it down to a set of solutions. It's not just one problem. It's not just reducing the number of centrifuges. It's a combination of a reduction in centrifuges plus a way of, or more possibly more than one way, of reducing the stockpile of low-enriched uranium, which I talked about last time, as clearly a necessary part of the deal. And So the use of this concept of a formula, meaning that it's a more complex solution to the problem than simply Iran agreeing to a big reduction in its numbers of centrifuges, that's a big clue that they were now in the space where it's possible to finish the negotiations. And of course, the 4 month extension takes them into November. That's you know, theoretically, the end of the 4 months would be after the congressional elections in the United States. And so this is just another reason for feeling confident, my confidence, that they are going to finish this within a reasonably short time. They're not going to reconvene, interestingly, the negotiations until September. They're going to take the month of August plus the rest of July off. They obviously will somehow, you know, communicate with one another during that period, but the negotiators won't sit down formally together until September, and I think they expect to be able to finish it that month. I'm reasonably confident that's the case.
That's great. And hey, it just came out the other day that they had finished part of their agreement, I guess a major part of their interim agreement, which was that they would go ahead and oxidize all of their 20% enriched uranium-235.
Well, I'm glad you've asked about that, Scott, because, of course, I have been very confused about precisely what was being said by the unnamed senior U.S. official who gave the briefing on the 19th about the agreement to extend the talks. There was this long paragraph which related to supposedly 2% enriched uranium. Now, no 2%. One's ever heard of 2% enriched uranium. I
right.
Sent an email to three different people who've been following the Iranian nuclear program very closely. I said, what's this about? I've never heard of 2% enriched uranium. I mean, there is you know, if you go to the Wikipedia article on 2% uranium, 2% enriched uranium, there is such a thing. It's called slightly enriched uranium, SEU. But nobody'd ever heard of it before. It's never been mentioned by the IAEA. It's never been mentioned by the news media. Well, guess what? It turns out that there is an agreement that relates to 2% enriched uranium.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, Iran has committed itself during this four-month period to take the apparently 3 metric tons of slightly enriched uranium, 2% enriched uranium, and combine it with depleted uranium, which will produce natural uranium. This is the result of one of the results of those talks in the final days to extend the negotiations. So now, precisely the significance of that remains to be explained. But my guess is that from what I've picked up so far, apparently Iran has a process for enriching the 3.5%, or enriching uranium to 3.5% or thereabouts. I mean, it's never precisely 3.5%. It varies with each batch slightly. And along the way, they produce apparently 2% enriched uranium. You know, it's in the stream of the enrichment process that comes out at the end of the pipe with the roughly 3.5% enriched uranium. So so now Iran has pledged to take the 2% enriched uranium, a stockpile apparently of 3 metric tons, which is a whole lot of it, which again no one has ever heard of outside the very narrow confines of those people who are most closely associated with this issue. They've pledged to turn that into natural uranium, and presumably what this means is that this is part of the process of assuring the P5+1 that there will not be a stockpile of low enriched uranium that could conceivably be used, you know, to be enriched at weapons grade for so-called breakout. Now, you know, I interpret that to mean that further down the line in the negotiations, they will be discussing doing the same thing for the 3.5 enriched uranium. In other words, that is going to be at least a major part of the solution to this conundrum of how do you get agreement on the level of enrichment capability for Iran under the agreement. Mm-hmm. I did talk to Scott Kemp at MIT, and I asked him point blank, is there any reason why this process of blending down would not be used for the 3.5%? He said, no, it'd be fine, and the Iranians probably wouldn't have any problem with that.
Huh. All right, well, hold it right there, and I got a couple follow-ups for you at least here. It's the great Gareth Porter, everybody, at Interpress Service. We're talking about the Iran nuclear deal. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Gareth Porter. And he's got a new one coming out here real soon on another one on the Iran nuclear program here and the talks about it. They've got their extension. And I was happy to hear you say there, Gareth, they're taking a couple of months off before they get back to it. Good. That's less time for them to screw it up. Hopefully, it's just final details at the end. How many centrifuges over what amount of time and all the little details to try to work it out. But as you say, both sides, you know, Kerry, the American side and the Iranians speaking pretty positively about it and all that. But now, so to get back to what we were just talking about the 2%, that's the first I ever heard of it, too. Obviously, my most likely source, if I ever was to hear about it, would have been from you. But I read those IAEA reports on Iran from time to time, especially when it's a real controversial one or something. I never heard anything about any 2%.
Yeah, it's never been mentioned, I can tell you. There's no such mention in anywhere in an IAEA report. So this is really quite remarkable, and I still want to try to get to the bottom of what it means.
It must be safeguarded material, though, right, or not?
Well, of course, yeah, it is. I mean, there's no question about that. This was something that, you know, I presume was proposed by the Iranians as part of the process of demonstrating their good faith in terms of assuring the P5+1 that there is no intention to have a capability for breakout. And again, I would just have to believe that this is related to the idea that would be logical to apply it to the 3.5% stockpile of low-enriched uranium.
They need that for their reactors, the 3.5 or 3.6% low-enriched?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. You know, they have the contract with Russia to provide the fuel rods for Bushehr until 2021. Now, the Iranian position, of course, is that they want to, and they will be, they claim, they will be in a position technologically to be able to take over that function by the time the contract comes to an end. So that's been the basis for their claiming that they need to ultimately have the enrichment capability to be able to support the Bushehr reactor by providing the reactor fuel. But, you know, I mean, that's not going to happen.
In other words, wait a minute. I'm going to make sure I understand you. You're telling me that right now the 3.6%, the stockpile of 3.6% enriched uranium that they have can be simply a massive bargaining chip to go ahead and give up. They don't even necessarily really need that at this point.
They don't. They certainly don't need all of that, they don't need very much of it for the Bushehr. They don't need for the Bushehr reactor for several years at the very least. And that's part of, you know, the negotiations are going on around, you know, how long it's going to be for this limitation on their number of centrifuges and their total enrichment capability, meaning the number plus the quality, the degree of capability for each of the centrifuges for the duration of this agreement. In other words, how many years are they going to be limited to either the present level of enrichment or something below that? And so the Iranians have been, you know, part of their negotiating ploy was to make it look like this is earlier. Now, not at present, but at an earlier stage, they were officially saying in the negotiations, look, we have to have enough capability to be able to provide nuclear fuel for Bushehr because we're not going to continue this this contract with the Russians. But the U.S. retort to that was, well, that's not going to happen for quite a few years, and in any case, we're not going to allow you to have 19 times more enrichment capability than you have right now or that you are using in operation. So, I mean, in fact, the Iranians never intended, as I understand their position and as it's played out, they never intended to insist on 190,000 separative work units as part of the immediate agreement, at least, you know, for the next X number of years. I mean, I think that they were prepared to wait, you know, until well beyond the expiration of the contract with the Russians to begin to expand their capability for enrichment. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I mean, that's the context.
I dig it. All right, now, so back to the 20% for a minute, because, of course, I think you were implying there that when you first saw that 2%, you thought it was a typo. That's what I thought you were going to say, and then it turned out it was a typo. But
I thought it was not a typo, but just confusion on the part of the person making, you know, doing the
Fair
briefing,
enough.
Yeah.
Well, but so I have this AP story from Haaretz that says 20%. And I'm wondering, did they just make that up because they thought, it must be a typo?
I think that's probably what happened, yes.
So this is from July the 21st.
Yep, I think that's what happened.
So the AP here said, well, the headline, who knows who wrote the headline? They're highly enriched, which, you know, technically, yeah, but nothing near bomb grade. But anyway, 20% made harmless is the way they call it. But they say, now tell me if this tracks the same with the weights and everything. Iran had more than 200 kilograms, over 250 pounds of 20% enriched uranium, and they have reduced it all. According to the IAEA report, which has been obtained by the Associated Press, all the 20% enriched uranium has now been converted or diluted.
That's right. That's true, but that's a separate point.
Yeah, entirely separate. Yes. Okay. I wasn't sure if they were misinterpreting it or it was just two different stories.
Okay, that is correct. That is a correct statement.
Well, and that's really important, not because 20% enriched uranium is important, but because it's a giant red herring fake issue within this entire giant red herring fake issue of Iran's nuclear program, that if you look at 20% uranium funny, it turns into a nuclear bomb. That it's just one light switch flip away from bomb grade, even though it's not. But anyway, for them to get rid of their 20% is very meaningful, at least symbolically, right? It's killing the red herring.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's certainly a step in that direction. Of course, you know, it doesn't resolve the issue from the point of view of those in the Obama administration, and of course, even more so the people who are trying to really screw up the negotiations, make sure they don't succeed, because they're making the argument that even a 3.5% enriched uranium is a threat if there's enough of it that could be turned into weapons-grade uranium. So that's why this whole process now has to do with a combination of reducing centrifuges and the stockpile and ensuring that no new stockpile begins to build up during the duration of the agreement. So, I mean, that's why, you know, we haven't talked about this yet, but what I am quite convinced of is that we're going to see an agreement that is roughly in the neighborhood of, you know, 8,000 centrifuges, you know, not much different from what Iran now has operating. The other 9,000 to 10,000 centrifuges will be scrapped effectively, and that's perfectly in line with, I think, what the Iranians expected all along, because, you know, they never hooked them up. They've never used them. Right. They've never operated them.
Yeah, as you said all along in this show, yeah, that's part of the pile of bargaining chips they're building up.
Exactly, and this is the most interesting, unreported, the most significant and interesting unreported fact about these negotiations all along, that the Iranians never intended to use them, and the Obama administration is perfectly well aware of that. I quoted an Obama administration official, not that I talked to, but who I think was the New York Times, quoted an Obama administration official 2 years ago saying that it's clear that Iran's very cleverly husbanding its resources here for future negotiations. That it wasn't explicitly stated negotiations, but that was the strong implication.
And by the way, have they worked out the locations between Natanz and Qom and where they're going to keep the remainder running?
Well, I think what we're going to see is a compromise under which the Fordo, or you know, the one near the city of Qom, is going to be used not for enrichment, but for research and development.
I think so that's holding. That they're going through with that. So
that's right.
That's another major, you know, pat on the back, so-called victory for the American side. Another one of their straw men.
Defeated. I mean, look, the Americans, remember 2 years ago they were insistent that 1 year ago and 2 years ago they were insistent that had to close down. Absolutely had to close down. Could not be stayed open. So, you know, both sides have compromised on that.
There you go. All right, well, we're all out of time. You can hear the music playing. Thanks very much, Gareth. Appreciate it.
As always, thank you very much, Scott. Bye-bye now.
That's the great Gareth Porter, everybody. IPSnews.net. IPSnews.net. See you tomorrow.